Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum, from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at the Bulwark. I'm joined by our regulars, Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center, Damon Linker of The Week, and Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and The Wall Street Journal. Our special guest this week is Desmond Lachman of the American Enterprise Institute, formerly Deputy Director of the IMF's Policy Development Department and Managing Director and Chief Emerging Market Economics Strategist at Solomon Smith Barney. So welcome one and all. Des, thank you so much for joining us. I was very thrilled to get your participation this week because you are one of the rare voices out there in the midst of a lot of cheering about this 1.9 trillion dollar stimulus. Of course, Damon also has some reservations, but there's a lot of happy talk. And you've written a little bit about your worries about inflation. So it looks like by the time this is all tallied, we will have spent something like $5 trillion since the start of the pandemic, which amounts to 25% of the pre-pandemic economy. Has there ever been anything like this in history, in our history?
Well, I don't think in the United States, you know, you might have to look south of the border to places like Argentina and Brazil to see that kind of fiscal irresponsibility. So this, in my mind, can't end very well. In the United States, we certainly haven't had this kind of peacetime fiscal stimulus. And it's, as you mentioned, we're talking about enormous amounts of money. So when we're looking at the Biden stimulus, that is an amount of $1.9 trillion. But that comes on the heels of a $900 billion stimulus that was agreed by the bipartisan Congress in December of last year. So what it means is that in 2021, the U.S. economy is going to get budget stimulus of the order of 13% of GDP. And it would seem that that is really running huge risks. You know, and I'd say particularly so in that budget stimulus isn't the only thing that's going on. You know, at the same time that we've got budget stimulus, we've got incredibly easy monetary policy. So what the Fed's doing is it's keeping interest rates low. It's continuing to buy something like $120 billion treasury bonds each month. And what that's doing is it's pumping up the money supply at the same time. So what we're seeing is the money supply increasing by 30%, which we haven't seen an increase anything like that in the last 60 years. So when you take together the excessive budget stimulus, the monetary policy ease, and on top of that, that there's a lot of pent-up demand that people haven't spent, you know, during the period that they've been under lockdown or changed their habits. Once Americans are vaccinated, they go out into the economy, we're really going to see a huge boom. So this is all going to feel very good going through this year. It's very likely to feel good, you know, as the economy grows by 6, 7, 8% the remainder of this year, growth that we haven't seen for many, many years. So it's going to feel good, but my fear is that we could get a very nasty hangover by 2022.
And Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, doesn't seem at all worried about inflation. What are the tools that are available to policymakers and central banks to deal with inflation? And how, you know, do you think he's not worried enough?
Oh, absolutely. That it's not, you know, if it was just me that was thinking that, that would be one thing, but it's what you're seeing in the bond market. So the bond market, what we've seen is a very sharp run-up in U.S. Treasury bond rates. You know, if you look at the 10-year rate, we've gone from less than 1% at the start of this year to something like 1.5%, 1.5% the last few weeks. That is a very rapid run-up. And what that's telling you is that the bond market thinks that Jerome Powell is behind the curve, that inflation is going to come in quite a big way. Another way you can see that the markets don't buy this is that their inflation expectations, the expectation of inflation over the next 5 years is now at 2.5%. That is above the Fed's target. So they're really concerned that Jay Powell is going to be slow to increase interest rates. You know, and when he does have to slam on the brakes, that sets the United States up for a recession in 2022. So I'm not sure that I understand the politics of this, you know, because if Biden is concerned about the midterm elections, he doesn't want to have the boom, a big boom in 2021, followed by a bust in 2022. But that is something that he could be setting us up for.
Let me ask you, to distinguish this case from what happened in 2009. So the Democrats believe that they went too small in 2009 with their recovery plan. And they point out it did not boost inflation, even though at the time there were a lot of warnings that that TARP and Recovery Act, which was, I think, 800 and something billion, was going to.
You know, that's a good point to bring up, you know, the comparison with 2009, because that'll just show how excessive this budget stimulus is. You know, as you mentioned, in 2009, we had a budget stimulus of $800 billion that Democrats are now saying wasn't sufficient. The economy was in very much worse shape in 2009 than it is today. Fast forward to today, and what we're seeing is a budget stimulus that is more like $2.8 trillion. You know, so we're talking about an order three times the amount of 2009. So maybe 2009 was too small, but it wasn't too small by $2 trillion. You know, so this is really what we're talking about. You know, you can make the argument that it was too small. You know, maybe we needed the Biden plan to be $1 trillion, but something like $2 trillion, you're talking about huge amounts of money that are going to be going into the economy, and that really risks setting off the inflation. You know, when you mentioned 2009, I should mention another risk that they're running, you know, which is more serious than the inflation risk that people like Larry Summers keep pointing out, and that is that you can get financial market dislocation, because it's good to remember that this budget experiment, this monetary experiment, is occurring in the context of what economists are now coming to call an everything asset and credit market bubble. You know, by that, what they mean is that we've got asset prices, like equity prices, for example. Equity valuations today are at levels that we haven't seen since the pre-1929 crash. So we've got very high equity prices, we've got very high house prices, we've got credit markets that are way overextended. And all of those markets are making the assumption that interest rates are going to stay low forever. Mm. What people's plan is risking is that if interest rates do rise, and as I mentioned, we've seen that rise already, we've seen first signs of it, that if, as you get the inflation, the interest rates go up, those bubbles in the financial markets could burst. And we know from 2009 that when that happens, that's not a pretty picture. So that is another reason why I believe that an excessive budget stimulus is really taking huge risks with the American economy.
Damon, you wrote this week that you were concerned about this lack of limits that the Democrats seem to, you know, they don't seem to think that there are any constraints on how much you can spend.
Yeah, I mean, I strictly speaking, they do think there are limits. I think most, at least aside from those who are kind of infatuated with modern monetary theory, which does seem to posit no limits, most people, especially elected Democrats, especially those in the Biden administration, recognize basic economic reality that, for instance, if we did get to full employment and then kept doing what we're doing, then we would clearly have a major spike of inflation. But short of absolute full employment, they sort of feel like, you know, pedal to the metal, hit the gas, and just keep spending until we get there. And that does create, in comparison to kind of the norm of the last 40 years, it does create a new dynamic where Democrats feel like it is perfectly fine to just sort of, you know, spend anything and everything in order to get everything, to get the economy running at a very fast clip. And it does create a very strange set of political incentives that I think could be pathological. For instance, you know, all of the stuff that's in this $1.9 trillion relief package, there's a ton in that we can't get into, but, you know, we're sending checks to huge numbers of Americans, $1,400, I think is what they settled on. Plus, we've started the child subsidy payments, which I support in principle as a good thing for the government to spend money on for all kinds of reasons, but we have that in there. Then there are a lot of supports in other aspects of the economy as well. And if in principle the idea is to just keep spending until we get to full employment, it's not clear to me why, again, on principle, Democrats wouldn't come out in favor of starting to, you know, in terms of deficit spending, tackle climate change in a big way and finally get us to universal health care. I mean, Bernie Sanders ran for president the last time, proposing something on the order of $60 trillion to $90-something trillion in spending. And note that that's a huge difference there, but it shows how kind of open-ended the spending proposals were, that people can't even agree on whether it's 60 or 97 trillion.
It was like Monopoly money.
Yeah, and that's precisely the right metaphor, because when you get to the point where we are now, where you have the Fed with its incredibly easy money approach combined with just enormous federal outlays, it's not even clear, like, where is this money coming from? We're like, we're not literally like printing money the way we used to talk in a more literal way, but unbelievably huge amounts of cash are being flooded into the market and into the economy. And it's not clear to me how, once you start doing that, you have any place on principle from which to say, no, that isn't a big enough priority to spend on, because then the other side can always say, well, we spent money we didn't have on these other things. Why can't we spend money we don't have on these things?
Right.
And the normal way politics works is that you have constraints that can't be moved, because you can't spend beyond a certain amount without raising taxes, which is unpopular. So you're constrained, and within those constraints, you prioritize. But if there are no longer constraints, then everything seems to somehow get flattened out as equally important, because everything we're spending is sort of made up monopoly money. Why not spend some more made up monopoly money on my pet project? So
yeah,
I'm concerned about that dynamic.
Yeah. I thought that was a really good point in your column. Linda, you know, Bernie Sanders is getting up there in age, and so he doesn't have the excuse of not being able to remember what the inflation of the 1970s was like. But I remember it. I was in high school, and I remember that there was a lot of panic, especially because inflation hits the elderly very hard, because who are living off their, well, in addition to Social Security, they're living off their savings, which is eroded by inflation. And it's very tough on the poor. And so, you know, I'm wondering whether this gamble that the Biden administration is taking is worth it. I mean, it seems to me that the risk is tremendous.
It is tremendous. And I just want to thank Desmond for completely ruining my day. Damon didn't help. You know, I'm 73 years old. I was sort of hoping to retire in 2022. And if the stock market indeed does crash, I'm going to be in very, very bad shape. It's not going to be nearly as nice a retirement as I hoped. And I think the problem is we have forgotten what an enormous tax, really, inflation is, and who it hurts the most. And of course, it hurts the most the middle class and the poor, and as you suggested, the elderly. And I mean, it is impossible for me to believe that you can pour this amount of money into a system, and particularly one where we are not in 2009 today. The economy is not in the shape that it was in our last big recession. And indeed, the reason we are in the shape we're in now is because of an external force, namely a pandemic, which had an enormous influence on shutting down the economy. Well, that is about to open up. So, you know, all of these industries, even American Airlines, they were very pleased they don't have to lay off 13,000 employees that they were planning on having to furlough, because the money now has come through and they're going to be able to keep them on board. Well, you know, I'm glad for those 13,000 people, but very soon you're going to start seeing airplanes fill up again. And that is going to mean that, you know, many of those 13,000 may not have been furloughed for very long. So I think, you know, we used to think of the Democrats as the tax and spend party. Well, you know, they've forgotten the tax part. It's now only about spending, and that cannot go on forever. And so I'm a little worried about this this huge stimulus that's just been passed. It's not that, you know, don't want to see money spent on good things, as Damon suggested, you know, it's got to come from somewhere and has to be paid in some way, and we're all going to end up paying for it.
Yeah, the Republicans, of course, have become the cut taxes and spend party, and we can't lose sight of that fact, that they've lost all credibility on matters of fiscal rectitude because of their conduct when the, you know, economy was booming under Trump, and they cut taxes and increased the deficit tremendously. So, so they have no credibility and bona fides. But Bill, I wonder if you're as worried as we are about the inflationary possibilities here, and also whether you possibly can answer this question, which is, I mean, it does seem, when you read what the Biden administration people are saying, that they are really bound and determined not to make the mistakes that the Obama people made. And they are, for example, Biden's going to make a speech tonight, and then he's planning a road trip to tout the benefits of this bill, because he feels that they didn't do enough of that in the Obama years and therefore didn't get credit for things. Okay, but why do they resist seeing that the 2009 economy was in a completely different place from where we are now?
I have so much to say and so little time to say it. You know, I can't help noting you know, this tone of lament for the good old days when Democrats raised taxes. you know, is it better to spend a lot of money and raise taxes to pay for these programs, or not to raise taxes at all? We shall see. But on the current situation, first of all, just to state clearly where I am, I got so frustrated a couple of months ago that I sat down and did my own budget, which I then circulated to Democrats and Republicans that I hoped might be compromise-minded. And I could justify spending about $1.1 trillion to deal with all of the pressing problems that have been identified. And the remaining $800 billion struck me as hard to justify on either macroeconomic grounds or as cures for particular ills that had been identified. So I am not complacent about the size of the bill that's heading to the president's desk, nor am I complacent about the possibility of, you know, across the board pressure on prices known as inflation. But this has a history, which is why those of us who are concerned are having a lot of trouble getting any traction. After Paul Volcker used brute force to wring the inflation that had built up in the 1970s out of the economy, we have been in a nearly 40-year cycle of declining interest rates and declining inflation. Two full generations of investors have grown up who did not experience what we experienced in the 1970s. And it is perfectly understandable why, after so many warnings of inflation resulting from budget deficits were sounded in the first two decades of the 21st century and no inflation ever materialized, that there should be some skepticism now when the same old arguments are trotted out. I happen to believe in a substantial portion of what Desmond stated, and I do think that virtually every economic force that I can now name is pointing in the same direction, namely higher inflation. But the world has changed too. I mean, the classic definition of inflation is too much money chasing too few goods. Well, the globalization of the economy has made the supply of goods a worldwide issue and not just a domestic issue. So while there's a real threat that the money, the purchasing power that's being generated will leak out into economies around the world, especially China's, we have to take into account the fact that the supply side of the supply-demand equation has changed pretty fundamentally. We don't know how much of a downward pressure that is exerting on inflation, but we're about to find out.
Right.
We're about to find out, and we'll see just how much the world has changed. Just one point of modest correction. Damon said, well, we're not exactly printing money. As Desmond pointed out, we are exactly printing money, the 21st century style. You know, the Fed is monetizing the debt to the extent of $120 billion per month. That's $1.4 trillion per year. And although these are electronic transfers in Fed accounts, it amounts to the same thing. And you don't have to be a dyed-in-the-wool monetarist to worry about the consequences of increasing the money supply as fast as we've been doing in recent months. And down the road, things are likely to happen on the inflation front that we're not going to like as a country But to conclude, nobody knows how big these effects are going to be in the new world economy in which we're living.
Okay. Des, final question for you. Unless Joe Biden listens to this podcast and says, wait a minute, I'm having second thoughts. He's going to sign this bill tomorrow. In light of that, what can happen to staunch the potential inflationary spiral? Is it just the Fed now that the Fed could raise interest rates, which of course would not, hamper the economic recovery? Are there any other things that can be done to ward off the inflation?
Well, you know, one of the things about the Fed is what the Fed should be doing is it should start raising interest rates. You know, monetary policy works with a lag. But basically what Jerome Powell has been telling us is that he's not going to raise interest rates anytime soon, and he's not going to stop printing the money by buying these bonds anytime soon, because in fact, he is in the camp that we need a little bit more inflation than we've had in the past. So he's going to be quite comfortable with allowing inflation to rise above his 2% target for some time. And he's not going to be thinking of raising interest rates until he actually sees the inflation. So that means that he is really going to be behind the curve in tightening the interest rates. And just to emphasize a point that Bill made, we are printing money in a big way. And I'm not talking about the Fed's high-powered money. I'm talking about broad money in the United States today is growing at a rate of 30%. That is the fastest rate that we've seen in the past 60 years by a long shot.
What is broad money? Sorry, can you explain?
Broad money is what people have got in deposit accounts, in savings accounts.
Oh.
Their money. It's not just the high-powered money that the Fed is printing. That unlike 2009, what we're seeing is that the banks are actually lending this money. So when the Fed buys these bonds, it multiplies up through the system. And we're now seeing the money supply growing by 30%. You know, and I would just recall that Milton Friedman famously said about inflation that it was everywhere and every time a monetary phenomenon. So when you see money supply growing at this kind of rate, you don't have to be a monetarist to know that something is way out of whack, yeah, and that we might have problems ahead. Just the last thing I'd say is, aside from the Fed, who is not going to interrupt this process, what could interrupt this process is if we get a return of the bond vigilantes. If these bond vigilantes send interest rates high on the long-term rate, that can burst bubbles. If the bubbles burst, we're going to be in a totally different ball game. We're going to be in the ball game that we were after the 2008-2009 U.S. housing and credit market bust, except it's going to be on a much larger scale because these bubbles now are global and these bubbles are really of a very big size.
Well, that's enough to ruin everybody's weekend.
Be prepared to work until 80, Linda.
Gosh, I am.
Right. Well, Desmond, thank you for sharing that with us and for your wisdom. And look forward to. We hope you're wrong, but we don't think you are.
I hope I'm wrong too. But as Bertrand Russell might have said, all the clues are pointing in that direction.
Yes. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye bye. All right. If a raging inflation in 2022 doesn't destroy the Biden administration, there's something else that might, which Linda, you wrote about this week, which is that we have a budding border crisis again, And the number of unaccompanied minors streaming toward the southern border has something like quadrupled since Biden became president. It seems pretty clear that it is in part because what message has gone out that, you know, the battle, cruel policies of the Trump administration are being abandoned in favor of something more humane. But now what to do?
All right. Well, I'm about to make your day a little bit brighter.
Okay.
Because it's really not as bad as it seems. Now, Kevin McCarthy is assembling, you know, a dozen Republicans to go to the border and try to make a big deal of this because the Republicans have no policy agenda. So without a policy agenda, let's beat up on illegal immigration. That seems to
right.
be the go-to issue for the Republican Party. Well, it's really not quite as bad. Yes. The numbers for February were very high. About 100,000 persons were apprehended at the border. But we have to understand who these people are and what is and isn't happening. First of almost 40% of those people who were picked up were recidivists. Now, why were they recidivists? Well, under the Trump administration last year during the pandemic invoked a public health provision called Title 42, which allowed the Border Patrol basically to kick people out immediately, no matter if they were claiming asylum or any other thing. They didn't have to go through any process. But it also did something else, which is to change the procedures. I mean, in the past, the provision in the immigration law in which you return somebody, once you've been caught once, if you come in again and try a second time, you are actually committing a felony under Title 8 of the immigration law. But they didn't use that provision. They used this health provision, and they didn't collect the information, and they didn't invoke any kind of greater penalty because Title 42 doesn't allow for that. And so you've got people who are essentially in a revolving door. So that 100,000 persons trying to cross, many of them are single men. And as I say, almost 40%, something like 37% of them. So in other words, 37,000 of those people are people who might have come in January as well and been turned back and are just coming back again.
Okay.
So that's one thing. The other is that we have, in fact, been more successful, even under the Biden administration, in discouraging people from heading to the border. Mexico was able to stop a caravan of new persons heading from Central America, turn it back. They also stopped a couple of busloads in March. And so most of the people who are coming through now are people who have been turned back in the past, are waiting just across the border. Now, there are some changes that have been humane, and I think we should all applaud, and that is under our asylum laws, you have to, number one, put foot on U.S. soil to claim asylum. And of course, because of the way in which the Trump administration invoked this public health law, they basically sent all those people back to Mexico immediately, letting them do what has been done in the past, which is to process their complaint. What the Biden administration has done is they're now letting in 25 asylum seekers per day. I mean, this is not thousands of people. It's 25 per day who are now being processed as they normally would have been in the past. They are, in fact, tested for COVID. It depends on the state and which, you know, border crossing they came through. But some states, California, for example, the San Diego crossing is imposing a 10-day quarantine on people. And that is, all of this is not necessarily bad. The one area, and it's the area I wrote about that I think is concerning, is the number of unaccompanied children that are now coming in. And again, under Trump, those unaccompanied children might, after the pandemic hit, would simply have been turned back to Mexico, where many of them were in very, very dangerous conditions. And so last month, there were 9,000 unaccompanied children. That's almost double what it was in January. And that is difficult because it's a very specific procedure, which I outlined in the article I wrote for The Bulwark about what you do with those children and how quickly They can be processed through the system and put in either foster homes or in many cases, most cases really, with family members who are already here. But the most important thing I think that the Biden administration is doing and should be applauded is that they have asked for $4 billion to try to deal with this problem at its source. These people are coming here because they're fleeing conditions having to do with drug cartels and gang activity and criminal activity and corruption, which makes it very dangerous for them to live in their home country. And so that money, which would be aid to Central America and not to governments, but to the through the private sector and in cooperation with the private sector and non-governmental organizations, try to get a hold of what is actually happening that is driving these people. So it's not quite as bad, but that doesn't mean that on Fox News and in Republican circles, you're not going to see an enormous, blowback because of these new numbers.
Linda, do I have this right that during the Obama years, they attempted to institute a policy of letting people request asylum from within their own countries, not having to put a foot on U.S. soil? Is
Absolutely.
That right?
That's exactly yeah. right. And there, and the new immigration law that the Biden administration is supporting does the same thing. They're going to try and create alternatives in third countries. They're going to try to find safe havens for people who are fleeing legitimate persecution. And that's the only way to solve this. You can't, I mean, the asylum laws that we created were not really intended, I don't believe, for the purpose for which they are now being used. Extreme poverty is obviously terrible, but that is not what the asylum laws were originally intended for. They were meant more for religious and political persecution. So they are going to try and deal with this, and I hope and hopefully they'll do it in a humane way. And by the way, listeners can go to the National Immigration Forum's website. There is an explainer on what's actually happening at the border. I'm a senior fellow there now, and a lot of this is available if you want to look into it further.
Thank you. Bill Galston, I was looking at a survey about what Republican-based voters really care about, and there are very few issues that are not culture war kinds of things that really excite them, except this one, except immigration. This is a potential political, major political vulnerability, I think, for the Democrats. Do you agree?
It is a potential vulnerability, but there's a difference between thunder on the right on this issue and broad-based opposition to what the administration is doing. I have taken it for granted that the Republican base will never go along with comprehensive immigration reform and will always be moved to paroxysms of fury by the latest emissions from people in the right-wing media talking about the immigration issue. The question, it seems to me, is whether the broad-based coalition that brought Joe Biden to power, coupled with reasonable Republicans who understand that the current status quo is not sustainable, are going to get together and try to have a more reasonable conversation about what needs to be done. I have to say, a skeptic that the Biden comprehensive immigration reform will do any better than comprehensive packages that have preceded it over the past 15 years. I hope Linda's more optimistic about that and can talk me into some greater optimism. But I think the best we can do for now is make progress piecemeal. So I strongly support breaking out the DACA issue and moving legislation for a clean DACA fix. That is DACA not linked to anything else. And Dick Durbin, with some support on the other side, including from Lindsey Graham, has been pushing such a proposal for a long time. I know for a fact that there are members of the Republican leadership in the Senate who support a clean DACA bill, and I think I regard it as low-hanging fruit that could be plucked if there's a decision to do so. I also think that we need, on a crash basis, a modernization and regularization of the terms under which temporary workers come into the United States, not just from south of our border, but also from Central and Eastern Europe. So we can mitigate the crisis to some extent, but we're not going to solve the problem unless we figure out a way of summoning the political will to do something that we've been trying to do since at least 2005 with no success.
Damon, I'm for doing something about those Canadian imports like Ted Cruz. There must be something we can do to keep them from coming across the northern border. But in any event, look, I was reading something about this the other day, and someone said, you know, that, oh, this is, if there's this press of new asylees and refugees and so forth at the southern border, it may torpedo efforts to get even DACA. Is that your sense of it? I mean, I did have the feeling, even during the depths of the Trump anti-immigration stuff, that DACA at least was one thing that most people thought they could come around to. Maybe not most Republicans, but certainly most Americans.
You would think so. I mean, even during the height of Trump's demagoguery on this, when he was president, polls would still show strong support, even among Republicans, for fixing the DACA problem. So you would think that would be low-hanging fruit. But the problem, I think, and it still might work, I should say that. I do think, I agree with Bill, that is probably the best path forward to make some progress on which we might build. And addressing that would help because it would take away that kind of recurrent problem that keeps coming up. But the bigger problem is that so much of the right now exists for the sake of the demagoguery, that things aren't said and done in order to fix problems. They're done to kind of whip up anger that then can be marshaled into people showing up to vote and giving the Republicans more power. There's kind of this pointlessness to it in the sense that there's no goal in mind policy-wise. It's just enhancing power. So, you know, what you mentioned earlier about Kevin McCarthy going to the border in order to make a big deal about the kids coming through. I'll note that in Linda's very good piece in The Bulwark about this, you know, just in passing, she notes along the way that when kids come across, they are required, the Customs and Border Patrol agents are required to let them in and hand them off to another agency within HHS by law. In other words, a law passed by Congress itself, so like all laws. So, you know, this is a problem that we have made ourselves. And for the Republicans to, you know, say, look, this is just an example there now. They've gone back on what the great Trump was doing, and they're letting these kids back in, and that's just going to encourage more kids to come in. Well, they're doing this because that's what the law says. And unless you're going to extend, you know, Trump's ban on letting people come in at all because of the pandemic, which is ending anyway, we have to deal with this, and it's our problem to deal with, but the Republicans don't seem to actually want to solve it because they gain by images on the news, on Fox News, that make it look like Biden has invited all of these people in illegally. So it's a poisonous situation, and again, my takeaway would be, yes, let's do our best to address the DACA problem and then try to maybe build from there.
So when you said it's a poisonous situation, my first thought was, so situation normal.
Yeah, probably.
So Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, said that, is that his first name, Greg? Yeah, anyway, Governor Abbott said that Biden was purposely bringing in illegals with COVID to the country. So there you go. That's the level at which they are arguing. And speaking of that, let's turn now to the state of the Republican Party, because it strikes me that with the passage of this very populist, huge spending bill by the Democrats, the Republicans, who have been advertising themselves as the new blue-collar party, are in a weird spot. So I'm going to start with you, Bill Galston. The Republicans, they have picked up some working class voters, as we talked about extensively on last week's podcast. It's not crazy, but at the same time, they don't seem to have grown into their identities at all. They seem not to have any real policy meat to put on the bones of just calling themselves the Sam's Club, not Country Club Party, to quote Marco Rubio.
I couldn't agree with you more, Mona. And there's a history to this. The working class has been migrating towards the Republican Party now for decades, really, since the cultural uproar of the late 1960s and early 1970s and the debate about Vietnam, where the working class, by and large, was on the hawkish side. And Republicans have reaped the political benefit of increased working class support without ever having to develop a working class economic agenda. To fully embrace a working class economic agenda would be to change policies in a number of areas where advocates of small government would oppose increased spending, where corporate Republicans would oppose all sorts of measures such as less free trade, less generous immigration laws, and others that would work, they believe, I think, with justice to their disadvantage. And so the space within the Republican coalition to shift economic policy in the direction of the working class, it has been pretty small, and it doesn't seem to me to be expanding, with one exception. And that is that Republicans, I believe, have abandoned any lingering affection that they might once have harbored for deficit reduction. I think it is now orthodoxy within the Republican Party that deficits don't matter. This is a trend that's been growing within the Republican Party for 40 years since Ronald Reagan said that he was going to cut taxes, increase defense spending, and lower the deficit. And when he was challenged a couple of years later, he said, in effect, well, two out of three ain't bad. And the number three in that list has remained third on that list ever since.
For Democrats, and, too.
Well, look, I'm not saying that Democrats were ever deficit hawks, although I happened to work for a Democratic president who was pretty close to one when you get down to
that
it.
Yeah, that is true.
But the real news here is that the Republican Party has joined the Democratic Party in this indifference, which means it's going to be a very long time before we ever again see the equivalent of the Simpson-Bowles Commission. It will take a real economic crisis to revitalize that line of thinking. But by and large, I agree with you that, you know, that the Republican, the working class in strictly economic terms has gotten remarkably little out of its alliance with the Republican Party.
Linda, we decided we weren't going to talk about the Royals on this podcast, and we've stayed away from Dr. Seuss, and we've stayed away from Mr. Potato Head, but I cannot resist, because it does say something about where the Republicans think their vote is and how they think they can keep their voters happy. We should talk about Neanderthal Gate because you know, you recall that several couple governors, Mississippi and Texas, said that they were going to open and they were going to eliminate mask mandates completely last week, and President Biden said that was Neanderthal thinking, and that of course got Fox News and the rest of the crew going. And so Senator Marsha Blackburn said this. She said, she said, Neanderthals are hunter-gatherers. They're protectors of their family. They are resilient. They're resourceful. They tend to their own. So I think Joe Biden needs to rethink what he is saying. Now, a couple points, Linda. One is Neanderthals went extinct about 30,000 years ago, so her use of the present tense was interesting. But is that the best way to keep the working class happy, is to defend Neanderthals?
Well, I beg to differ in disagreeing with you. Yes, as a group, they went extinct. But for any of you who have taken the 23andMe or some of the other DNA tests, you can, in fact, find out how much Neanderthal DNA you carry.
That is true.
And I have to say, I'm a conservative, but I have less, apparently, than the average person of Neanderthal genes. So,
by the way, they had bigger brains than modern Homo sapiens.
They did.
Yes.
And it now appears that they had language. We're finding out that they were at least capable.
So Marsha, we're with you, baby.
Yeah, we're with you. But look, I do think that was a mistake on his part. So we all remember what the deplorables accusation cost Hillary Clinton. Some people think it may have cost her the election when she referred to the basket of deplorables that constituted Donald Trump's base. I'm not altogether in disagreement with
with her analysis
for now, but nonetheless, I do think, you know, there is a problem. The Republican Party has had a coalition that was more blue collar. You and I worked for Ronald Reagan, the Reagan Democrats. That's how I became a Republican. I was first a Reagan Democrat, then became a Republican. And you know, he did manage to appeal, and it is clear that those who have voted Republican in the past, I wouldn't disagree with Bill Colston. Sometimes they voted against their economic interests in doing so. But the cultural issues mattered. And frankly, that seems to be all the Republicans have right now. They don't seem to have any kind of coherent policy in a variety of areas. And we've talked about it on the program. They're not even in favor now of taxes that pay for programs, and they seem to be embracing many of the programs like the child care, not child care, but the child subsidy that was included in the $1.9 trillion package. You've got, you know, Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio and Senator Lee all sort of signing on in favor, not necessarily of that proposal, but of something that would give money to families. So, look, the Republicans, they need to get their act in order. They need to decide what it is they're in favor of and have it be coherent. And if they want to go after blue-collar workers, I think they're going to need more than just a crisis at the border to do so.
I would just add, though, that I think it's fair to say that Republicans have not been for raising taxes. They've been all about cutting taxes for the last several decades since Reagan. And so you had this great symmetry of Republicans always cutting taxes and Democrats always raising spending, and Republicans too. And so we're in the hole we're in. But Damon, there's been another Republican senator who announced that he's not seeking re-election this week. That was Roy Blunt. So that the total now comes to five: Roy Blunt, Richard Shelby, Richard Burr, Rob Portman, and Pat Toomey have all announced they are not seeking re-election. Some people have called them the governing wing of the Republican Senate. What's your analysis of why they're bailing out?
Well, I haven't interviewed any of them, so I don't really know in any particular case, but I guess I would do the pundit thing and speculate and say that it probably is pretty unpleasant to be a Republican office holder right now, unless you're very much of the kind of Trumpian ilk and sort of get off on and thrive on, you know, being talked about on social media, going on Tucker Carlson, and speaking to crowds of people who cheer on kind of red meat. That's pretty much all that there is these days on the right, unfortunately. And so I think these older guys, you know, who've been around for a while, they've been in the Senate for a while, they've enjoyed the perks and the stature and maybe even contributing in some ways to issues that they care about, and probably think that the future looks darker than the past and it's time to get out. You know, 6 years is a long time to hold the term. And, you know, someone like Pat Toomey, like, it's so funny, as a sort of Democratic-leaning centrist, and I live in Pennsylvania. When he was elected, I thought, oh, he's so, like, libertarian, economic, like, he's the club for growth. Like, I really didn't like him at all. And now, you know, just a couple of terms later, I'm like, ah, he's one of the good ones. He actually stands up to Trump and actually cares about, I don't know, the rule of law. Wow, that's rare. So, you know, I for someone like that, I definitely sort of feel for him. Like, yeah, I don't blame you. If I were you, I probably wouldn't want to deal with this crap anymore either. It's pretty thankless. I think the people who really are kind of thriving in the current environment are those who have been willing to kind of flip a switch in their brains and embrace this new Trumpian style of politics that's almost entirely based on negative partisanship, attacking the left, sort of either explicitly lying or doing extreme exaggeration. Like Kevin McCarthy, you know, this will be my one example of this. And of course he's in the House, not the Senate, but it's the same dynamic that last week, the Democrats are passing this gargantuan, relief package, and what does Kevin McCarthy do? His most prominent public act that I saw last week is that he made a 5-minute video of himself reading The Cat in the Hat in order to send a zinger about Dr. Seuss over toward the left and whip up the base. If you can get into that and, you know, leave that 5-minute videotaping and feel like, ah, I put in a good day's work in the name of the public interest, then Washington is the place to be. But if not, you know, maybe it's time to get out.
Yeah. Bill, did you want to add something?
Yeah, just very briefly. I think the real news out of these five announcements is that in, I believe, all of these states, there are going to be quite divisive primaries between Trumpified, you know, young potential replacements for these senior senators and those who are cut more from the cloth of the governing wing of the Republican Party. And I'm afraid that in current circumstances, the Trumpy candidates are going to have the wind at their backs. And many of them come from red states where the winner of the Republican primary is likely to be the next senator from that state. And so I'm afraid that however bad the atmosphere in the Senate has been and however ill-suited it's been to serious governing, it's going to get worse.
Yeah, just to underline that point, Rob Portman, who was no profile in courage when it came to standing up to Trump, but who wasn't actually Trumpy himself, is retiring. And one of the people who's campaigning for his seat is Josh Mandel, who until the day before yesterday was basically your, you know, garden variety, typical Republican office holder and office seeker. Well, of course, now he is transforming himself into a MAGA guy. And he says he wants to go to the Senate to fight for President Trump's America First agenda, and he has denounced Governor Mike DeWine as a squishy establishment politician, and on and on and on. So that's a good harbinger of where things are headed. Okay, let us now turn to our final segment, something we want to highlight or condemn. Damon, start with you.
Okay, well, given the amount of time we spent today talking about economics and kind of anxieties about inflation and spending, I wanted to highlight a piece actually from quite a while ago, from January, but it's so good, it stuck with me ever since, and I went back to it this week in writing the column of mine that, Mona, you mentioned when we were talking about this at the top of the podcast. It's by Bloomberg's economic columnist, Noah Smith, who has, as so many do these days, a Substack blog. And he, on that blog on January 22nd, wrote of an item titled, "No One Knows How Much the Government Can Borrow." And this is one of the best pieces of economics, economic commentary I've read in a long time. He just digs into the literature among economists on this question of not just inflation, but hyperinflation, which is the real kind of cataclysm that everybody fears as the worst case scenario. Where you end up not with, you know, 5 or 10 or 20% even inflation, but hundreds or thousands percent of inflation, like most recently Venezuela has been saddled with catastrophically. And he just goes through the literature and points out that economists do not really understand what causes it and whether it's going to happen, how to forecast it. He uses a very compelling, simple image of how at the moment with these huge outlays that we're seeing right now are sort of stumbling down an infinitely long corridor toward a pit of hyperinflation. And we literally do not know if that pit is 10 feet in front of us or 10 miles in front of us. And if for anyone who's really trying to think through these issues and trying to base it in something like either empiricism or hard tested theory, this piece will really show you that we are stumbling around in the dark and we truly do not know how much money we could conjure out of the ether without having a really bad consequence from it. So it's worth reading and thinking about and keeping around.
Excellent. Damon, I think you might be single-handedly keeping Substack going. I
mean, that's true. Well, at least someone like Matt Iglesias is great, and so is Noah Smith. So, certain policy people, I think, are really thriving there because it gives them a lot of flexibility about what they write.
Well, I've been following your lead. I subscribe to Matt Iglesias. I might have to do the same for this Noah Smith. All right, Bill Galston.
Yeah, well, I want to shout out a thoughtful young Republican senator from Indiana, Todd Young, who's been one of the driving forces in the development of what is called the Endless Frontiers Act, which is the first really comprehensive effort to size up the Chinese technological challenge and to respond to it. It calls for a number of long overdue policies, turning the National Science Foundation into the National Science and Technology Foundation, raising very substantially the amount of funding going to both basic research and applied research, targeting certain areas where the Chinese challenge is particularly acute. And Young, Senator Young, has teamed up with, hold your breath, Senator Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, to introduce this bill last year. And lo and behold, Schumer is now talking about making it the centerpiece of the next big bill to be considered by the Senate. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but even the public discussion of this possibility is a big step forward toward a bipartisan response to the Chinese challenge, which is long overdue.
Okay, Linda.
Well, I'm going to pick up on Bill's lead, as I often do, and turn to something that has to do with foreign policy. The publication Persuasion, which is run by Yasha Monk, who's a friend of ours, and I think has been on the program as well.
Yes, he has.
Has a terrific piece this week on Alexei Navalny. It's called Amnesty's Disgrace. The rights organization shunned Navalny. It's what Putin would have wanted. As I'm sure our listeners all remember, Alexei Navalny was on death's door. He was poisoned by Putin's thugs as he was leaving Russia, and he eventually returned because he has been the leading opposition to Vladimir Putin. And he was recently sentenced to 2.5 years in a labor camp, and he's now sort of disappeared from sight. We're assuming that he has been sent off to a labor camp. And he was considered in the past by Amnesty International as a prisoner of conscience, but he's now been taken off the list. And this article by Yevgenia Albots goes into Navalny's history. Navalny is not exactly the ideal opposition to Putin. For those of us who believe in democracy, he has had ties to the nationalist movement. He's called, you know, he's in the past, he's made some unfortunate comments and allied himself with some people that were not altogether great. But the idea that he is somehow a fascist or a Nazi, as apparently Putin's people are trying to promote and Amnesty may have picked up on, is simply wrong. So I just recommend it to our listeners.
Okay. Bill, did you have something you wanted to add?
No, ma'am.
Oh, sorry. Okay. All right. Well, mine, let's see. I have two quick things. One is I was paging through the executive orders issued by President Biden, as one does, and I noticed that he has revived the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, which is interesting because it was started by George W. Bush, and it was headed at first by a Democrat, John DiIulio, friend of mine. And then it was allowed to sort of go into desuetude, though it was still on the books during the Obama administration. It kind of had a low profile. But Biden is choosing to revive it. It's an interesting thing to note because there are some people, especially on the right, who think that they have a monopoly on religious in concern or sympathy. And Biden is actually a churchgoer, and even though he doesn't apparently agree with the Catholic Church on things like abortion, he does take his religion seriously. So it'll be interesting to see what he does with this office. And my other quick item is from the Bulwark. It's up today and for the next couple of days, I hope. It's called Take It From a Swede, Forget the Fight for 15. It's by obviously a Swedish writer who notes that there are consequences of, first of all, he notes that if we adopted a $15 minimum wage, it would be higher than anything in Western Europe. And that with some of the countries, including Sweden, that have instituted high minimum wages, have found that it causes a problem with unemployment among immigrants, and that this causes even more social problems. So it's an interesting perspective, and I highly recommend it. It's called Take It From a Swede, Forget the Fight for 15 on thebulwark.com. Linda, did you want to add something? Okay. Maybe we're having a problem with our technology.
No, I did want to just maybe correct you slightly.
Okay.
I don't think that it's fair to say that Joe Biden does not agree with the Catholic Church's position on abortion. I do believe that he thinks abortion is a mortal sin, to the taking of a life. The question is whether or not he supports a separation between his personal, private, religious beliefs and public policy. And so I'm not quite
duly noted. Yes. No, that's fair enough. Yes, we'll make that correction. All right. Well, we want to thank Desmond Lachman again for joining us. And we want to thank all of you for listening. Kindly rate and review us. You can find my email if you go to thebulwark.com, and you can also join, become a member of The Bulwark and join us for our live streams. We're going to have one tonight. We have one every Thursday night for our members, and it's informative and fun. Everybody participates either on screen or in the comments, and we will be back next week as every week.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.